Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody. Hey, welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, kicking off your happy hour and hopefully getting your weekend going in the right direction. And sure, you bet the views of this host and this show certainly do not reflect the views of much of what you will find on this station. That's right. Got a really, really interesting show coming up for you here today. Kind of came to pass by chance, which is always great. Made a new friend at Tales of the Cocktail. And the gentleman's name is Steve Ray. Now, Steve is an author. He's a lecturer. He's a consultant. He is also a fellow podcast show host and many, many other things in the wine and spirits world. And an area of Steve's expertise is understanding the U.S. market for wine and spirits. And he works with a lot of folks outside the U.S. and assists them essentially in bringing their stuff into the country. And if you're in the industry, you probably know this quite a bit. If you're a serious enthusiast, you may already know this too. But the United States is basically a patchwork, a quilt work, if you will, of the different states and a couple other entities that have their own set of regulations and own processes. It can be very difficult to navigate that. That's one layer of all this. Of course, there's consumer preference, how people read labels in this country and the information they want on labels. There's a whole, we're going to get into this in the interview. There is a whole host of stuff that people have to navigate when trying to get their product to market. And that affects consumer choice. You know, what is available here and what is not available here in many instances comes down to their ability to actually navigate this place and get it in here. And so the purpose of this show is to kind of give you an understanding of how the market in the U.S. and how the process, the logistics, the whole thing works for folks trying to get stuff into the country, and then therefore how that affects you and your ability to get your hands on things and taste things and experience things, be exposed to things, so on and so forth. Hopefully that makes sense. It is a really, Steve will make a lot of sense of this for you, I promise. Maybe I won't, but Steve certainly will. It's a really, really interesting conversation if you're, like I said, in the industry or an enthusiast who just cares about how we get stuff here and what our consumer choice is and then what people actually face to get their products to us. Great stuff. Really, really fascinating conversation. Can't wait to bring it to you. A couple quick programming notes. We are going to be taking a break here. Let's see, after this one, we're going to have 1 week off and then we're going to be back talking to Dave and Lance from St. George Spirits all the way out there in the San Francisco Bay Area in California. A super fine craft distillery. They make some fantastic juice. I mentioned this last week. Can't wait to talk to these guys. They're going to taste through some stuff, get their story, learn about their terrific products. Really, really cool distillery. I'm really happy to bring that to you. I know down the road that we are going to be chatting with our friends once again from Turning Tables, who recently went to Mexico. We're going to be chatting with the folks from Denada Tequila in the near future and a whole host of other things going on, friends. So just be on the lookout for that. As I said, week off next week, and then we're going to be back at it. So what we're going to do right now is we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show, and then we're going to be back with U.S. wine and spirits market expert Steve Ray. Come on back.
Get in the groove and let the good times roll. We're going to stay here till we soothe our soul. It takes all that long.
I'm Liz Williams, host of Tip of the Tongue on the Nitty Grits Podcast Network. Join me and weekly guests for conversations about food and drink and the people who create food culture around the world. The show is for the curious, hungry for food knowledge. My new book, Nana's Creole Italian Table, about the Sicilian community in New Orleans, can be pre-ordered from Amazon. Learn more about Nitty Grits Podcast Network at southernfood.org.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thanks for listening into the show, friends. Happy to have you here and a very happy to bring you my next guest. I mentioned all this at the top of the show. We are chatting with a U.S. market expert for wine and spirits, and does a whole, and that means a whole bunch of things that we're going to get into. And my new Tales of the Cocktail friend, Steve Ray. Steve, how are you?
There you have it. That, I think that was the most important part there at the end, was the fortuitous meeting at Tales of the Cocktail, and find out that we're both sides of the same coin and doing many of the same things. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, Steve. It's an absolute pleasure. It was great to meet you at Tales, and I know we're going to talk about other things, but you and I just sort of met by happenstance in a tasting room, and you were working with a really fine producer of chocolate liqueurs, and I'm assuming that you probably get this reaction a lot, or they get this reaction a lot. I was kind of thinking, chocolate liqueur, interesting. Okay, how good can it be? Wow, that stuff was really good.
Yeah, that's kind of the fun part about my job, is I get to pick and choose who I want to work with. And I think in this day and age, pretty much everybody who's bringing a new product or a product to the market, the quality of the product is good, whether it's a wine or whether it's a spirits. I mean, the technology today and the chemistry is good enough to be that everything should be certainly drinkable, if not, you know, of good quality for the price category that it's in. In this particular case, they take it to a very, very high level and back it up with sustainability and all of the cues that are important to Gen Z and millennials. And I drank the Kool-Aid, bad metaphor there, but I was lucky enough to go to chocolate school in London and learn about how they make chocolate and learn about the chemistry and the crystallization and the history and heritage and where it comes from, what makes good and what isn't. And it's astonishing. This is like some of the best chocolate you'll ever taste. I want to tell this story because it was fun. Everybody who comes to taste this product goes through the exact same thing.
Yeah, I would imagine. Yes.
They smelling, oh, chocolate. Okay, so they know they're going to like it when they taste it. Oh, that's good. Then like about 10, 15 seconds pass and they go, no, that's really good. And then their eyes look up at me and go, no, you don't understand. This is really good. And yeah. Everybody goes through that same process, which is kind of neat that people can identify and differentiate. Not that Hershey's is bad, but I grew up eating Hershey's, right? Sure. And this is an entirely different category and quality level of chocolate that you never even knew existed, which is exciting to discover.
Absolutely. Steve, tell me, and I apologize because I've forgotten. What is the name of the brand? Of the liquor?
The brand is called Hotel Chocolat without the E at the end. It got the name. Actually, there is a Hotel Chocolat. They own an estate in St. Lucia where they grow their own cacao. It was a cacao farm and built a hotel there called Hotel Chocolat. It's been the name of this very high-end chocolatier in the UK. They've got like about 120 stores throughout Great Britain. And a friend of mine had gotten the gig and reached out to me and said, I need some help. These people want to come to the US. It's what you do. Can you help me? And of course I said, yes.
Yeah, cool. Well, and actually that springboards to what I want to talk to you about first, Steve, is, you know, I mentioned that you're a US, and I mentioned this at the top of the show, you're an author. We're going to talk about the podcast that you do a little later on in the show. You do consulting, you do a lot of different stuff. So obviously these people reached out to you for a reason, because of your expertise in the U.S. market for wines and spirits. Can you give us a 2-minute, and I know it's a pretty short amount of time, 2-3 minute bit of background on what it is that you do and how you found yourself here doing what you do?
No, I need 5 minutes. No, okay. I'm just kidding.
5 is fine. I can give you 5. 5.5, Steve, and we're out.
2, I can't do. No, I can. I've been in the industry for about 35 years. I started in the industry in a company that is now called Diageo in brand management on
never heard of
vodkas.
Of I'm kidding.
Never Sorry. Heard of it. Okay, right. And Smirnoff and Finlandia, you probably never heard of too. And we were also the import company for a whole lot of really high-end fine wines, particularly from Italy. So that's kind of been my experience. I at one point owned a very successful ad marketing PR agency. We had offices in Connecticut and New York. Did a lot of work for major companies in the U.S. and specialized in helping new to the market brands launch in the U.S. And that kind of became my focus level of interest. And I've done a whole lot of things, everything from partnering with WSWA to create a forum exploring that whole category. I wrote a book called How to Get U.S. Market Ready, which is basically a primer for people on how to do it. And the way I state it is to help people not make the same mistakes everybody else made before them again for the first time.
Right.
And then from that came a lot of notoriety, visibility, and I've gone on and done other things, as you mentioned, being the podcast and a couple of other things. But that's basically it. Okay. About 2 minutes.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you. We're gonna kind of tease more of your background out as we talk about some of the different things that you do. But let's start there, Steve, with talking about the U.S. market. I think this would be a bit of an understatement to say this, that the landscape for the market really around the world, but certainly in the United States, being such a desirable market, has just changed so much over the past, pick a number, 15, 20, 25 years. You know, we've gone from kind of, we talked about this when I interviewed on your show, which will be, I'll mention, will be coming out in a few weeks, that, you know, we used to kind of have like there was a set of talking about wine specifically, a set of columnists, a few authors or a few, you know, publications, some things like that, that kind of dominated the knowledge landscape. And then you were sort of dependent on what you got at your local retailer or your local bar. All bets are off now, right, with the internet and the amount of information that's out there. And that's got to have had a trickle-down effect to just how the market works, right, and how people can function, get their product in the market, and how consumers can access both information and specific products.
Yeah, and I think that, call it transparency, a metaphor for that or an example of that is the auto industry. It used to be that the only person who had the information on how much the car cost and what the margin was and what's included and what's not was the dealer. Now that's all transparent. You can get it online. And the same thing is true in the wine category and the spirits category. So all this information is available to everybody. That's a blessing and a curse. There's a lot to go through. We also have tools today like label recognition technology, which works on both wine, spirits, as well as beers and whatever categories you want, RTDs, seltzers, and so forth, that allows us as marketers to be able to identify someone at the precise moment in time that two things are in place. One is we know that they're interested in the product because they just took a picture of the label. And two, that they hold it in their hands, which means they're probably in at a position where they can buy it. So if you can compare that to the way we used to communicate to consumers in, you know, the distant memory, meaning like 20 years ago, when we would do things like advertising.
Wow.
And people would be looking, right, looking at a magazine and hopefully seeing a brand catching their attention. And then at some time in the future, which could be 1 or 2 months hence, that they'll make that connection. Now it's all happening precisely at this one moment in time, and all the things come together. And I think that is a metaphor for the way people are shopping now. They want more information than what's available on the label, but not too much. They want some basic information. I think the typical consumer has really two questions when it comes to wine. What does it taste like? And in parentheses, I would say in words that I understand and mean something to me.
Right.
And by that, I do not mean sauteed gooseberries. I've never had a gooseberry, and I don't know what a sauteed one tastes like. And the second one is, will it go with what I'm having tonight? And as a marketer, I get asked this all the time, what's the best bottle of wine? And my answer is a very flippant, the one I just sold.
Right, exactly.
I mean, we're in a commercial business. We're trying to sell wines. And so when you ask the question, is it going to go with what I have for dinner last night? Generally, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Well, it may not be a perfect match, okay?
Sure.
But will it go with what I'm having, depending on the sauce and all the rest of that stuff? I think there's this whole thing about wine and spirits or wine pairing that's maybe taken a couple of levels too high. But
yeah, I think you're right about that. And I mean, we'll talk about that maybe a little bit later, because I think when we talk about the so-called rules of wine pairing, when you're talking about, you know, 16th century continental Europe rules of wine pairing, it's a pretty narrow. Nobody accounted for drinking wine with Szechuan cuisine, for example, at that point in time.
But Steve, much less with Carmenere from Chile.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, you know, and yeah. I was going to ask you this one a little bit later, but since you brought it up, talking about labels, and you know, it's always such an interesting game when you go into a bottle shop and you pick up a bottle and you work with Italian wines, for example. And, you know, for me, I do like if it's, say, you know, a blended wine of some sort, be it white, be it red, you know, certain appellations, if you know what you know, say like in France and stuff, you know what the grapes are by the appellation in general. But, you know, I'll pick up a certain bottle, it'll say this percent of Cabernet Sauvignon, this percent of Merlot, and this percent of Cab Franc. And you go, great, thank you. That actually tells me a lot. And in other instances, it's just like red wine. And you don't really get much else. And it's kind of all over the place. Now, when you work, because of what you just said, what people want to know, how much information is too much, how much information is too little. And when you're working with producers, you know, kind of how do you help them strike that balance of and the recommendations that you give them to provide Sure. the right level of information?
Well, the key one is use the common language that is in their audience, and it is not centigrade, it's Fahrenheit. And it's not degrees alcohol. It's proof.
It's proof.
I'm talking about spirits as an example, but I think the way people shop is very different. Particularly in the US versus Europe, old world Europe. In America, we shop through by varietals. What is it made of? And yes, blends, but by varietals. So it's predominantly Cabernet Sauvignon or Pinot Noir, whatever it happens to be. In Europe, it's typically geographic. So it speaks to a place, a region, a town, or a particular, you know, category of wine that's produced in a particular area. And Americans have, you know, we have very little understanding or experience in the details of geography in different regions of France, much less Italy or Spain or Germany or Hungary or Romania. And so I've been worked with companies in all those countries, as well as other continents, Australia, New Zealand, South America with Chile and Argentina and all the rest of that stuff. And what's happened is kind of the world has come around. So if you had drank Bordeaux, you drank a red blend. Typically it was Cabernet Sauvignon with, I think there were four or five other grapes that are typically part of it, yep, blended with it, Merlot and Cabernet Franc being two of them. Now in America, we're drinking red blends, and it's like there's this discovery of, hey, there's this new thing. It's red blends. It doesn't matter what the varietal is. It's how they make it. Well, you know, what's old is new again. That's kind of happened. And a whole new generation, multiple generations, are discovering this anew for the first time, which is cool.
That's very cool. So it is. So I think that's a really great point that you made, because you're talking about, say, with European markets and audiences, they're going to have a familiarity with kind of what's in the bottle based on the geography. Whereas here in the US, like, we like to see what the varietals are, and we like to see, I mean, I love to see the pH, you know, the acidity on the back of the bottle and some things like that. Or at the very least, you know, I want to be able to go to your website and see if you have a tech sheet that tells me some of those key numbers. But I realize I'm not the average consumer, and that goes a little far. But I'm always just very curious, because that is one of those things that's out there. And I do see more imported wine speaking to the US market that does tell me what the percent of the blend is at the very least. And I think that's a market adaptation to here, is it not?
Yeah. And I think the important thing, what I advise people, is let's make sure that the back label is giving people the story, or at least the incentive to dig into the story. And they want to know things like, you know, who makes it? Is it sustainably produced? Is it organically produced? What is the history, heritage of this particular product? Why is it of relevance to me? You can't explain all of that in the label, but I wrote this once for a Ribera del Duero. Mm-hmm. And the idea was, I said, you know, people want to know what it tastes like, and will it go with what I'm having for dinner tonight? Here's eight words. Goes great with tapas. Try it with tacos.
I like that. That's great.
Told you everything you needed to know. Goes with spicy food, right? Gives you the Spanish thing. You don't really need the varietal. It's like, okay, it's a heavy red wine. I get that. It goes with this spicy stuff. So I think there's an opportunity here to speak briefly, but cogently, to the needs and interests of people on the back label, and then also include, we recommend using QR codes. Can you imagine that QR codes have come back for a second life? That lead you directly to, if you want more information, you can go here. All of the scores, critics, ratings, reviews, all those kinds of things. But at the end of the day, you want to create some connection with people with the back label, and that's really what it has to do.
Okay, excellent. Steve, perfect timing. Let's do this. Let's take a little break here on the show. We're going to come back, chat a little bit more about navigating the U.S. market for wines and spirits. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show. Come on.
Hey, everybody, Roger here with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Be sure to check out Nitty Grits Podcasts, a growing network of shows about food, drink, and culture. Visit southernfood.org for more.
Sitting here, la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh. Sitting here, la la, waiting for my ya-ya. Oh. It may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here. Thanks for joining me on the NOLA Drink Show, chatting with Steve Ray, U.S. market expert for wine and spirits. Steve, we were just talking about this during the break. If you hear a little bit of noise in the background, the gardeners are here cutting the lawn. So I apologize for that as we tape, but, you know, the show must go on, so we're going to continue the conversation one way or the other. Steve, we're talking about navigating the U.S. market for folks, you know, importing stuff or producers from outside the country. And I think a lot of listeners of the show probably already know this. It's a tough landscape, right? And it's a checkerboard, is it not, here in the United States, as far as every state's different. And then we even have some local particularities that take place. That's got to be a huge challenge for people just to even get their head around.
Yeah. And instead of a checkerboard, I analogize it to it's like playing three-dimensional chess.
Like Star Trek chess. I like that. Yeah, right on.
they're exponential. And so I think the misunderstanding happens from certainly from people outside the U.S. that the U.S. is, as far as the wine and spirits industry is concerned, one market, and we're not. We have 52 different regulatory entities. We are more Balkanized than the Balkans because we have the 50 states plus D.C. plus Montgomery County, Maryland operates as its own control regulatory entity. And the rules are such that what is illegal in one market may be preferred in another market. And you need to know this intuitively. So oftentimes when people say, I want to come to the US, that's a trigger, right, to me to say, how much do you understand? And in fact, that's why I ultimately wrote the book, so that I didn't have to have this conversation. And when people call me up and say, can you help me? I said, well, I can do better than that. I'm going to either send you a copy of my book or I'm going to make you buy it, depending how nice they are to me. And then I say, I'll give you 2 weeks. We're going to have another conversation. And yes, there will be a test. And I ask them some basic questions. Can you define a franchise state to me? Can you tell me what FET means? You know, some basic things that you need to know. And if they've had access to the book and they clearly haven't read it, then I don't really want to work with them because they just said they don't want to do the homework. And this is very hard. And you will get caught out in the first 30 seconds with any conversation with anybody who is a gatekeeper, whether they're an importer, whether they're a distributor, whether they're a distributor salesman, whether they're a retailer or an on-premise account. You use one phrase incorrectly or not know what something means, and antenna pop up right away. He's not, or she, they are not one of us. And if you're an outsider, that's a big problem.
Wow,
you need to be included. And that's one of the functions I perform. There's a lot of people who do what I do, which is, you know, help people navigate the complexities of the U.S. market. We don't want to say that everybody knows everything, but we also want to make sure that they don't make any egregious mistakes that are call-outs to people to say they're not ready.
Interesting. That's really interesting because I had no idea that you could be totally castigated for using the wrong terms.
Castigated, judged
harshly.
That's
wow,
worse.
That sounds like old sommelier stuff to me. Like that's really interesting. But you know, just so for listeners who don't know, will you tell people what a franchise state is and what FETs are, just because they may ask that question?
So there is a test, huh? Okay.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, all right. So
don't say it's in the book.
State,
all right.
Franchise state. And it goes back to automobiles, that Henry Ford had this idea that he was going to have dealerships around the country and give exclusive territories to dealerships. And the law reflected the fact that if it was granted to somebody else, it couldn't be taken away. So there's this whole canon of law that addresses franchises in that regard. The same thing is true with distribution in certain states. And those states include Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, and Georgia and Nevada, for that matter, are the ones that are really, really significant. And basically, the practicality of it is if you engage a distributor you can never fire them. You might be able to go dual. We call that dueling or even tripling, but you cannot fire them. And so if they're not performing a function, if it doesn't fit in the way you're structured to go into the market or how you've evolved to go into the market as your brand is developed, you can be kind of stuck. And that's where this three-dimensional chess thing comes in, because you're making decisions early that may or may not preclude you from opportunities that are going to come in the down the road. And what I try and do, I have proprietary tools that I've put together that are in the book. Actually, I give them away for $34.99 to figure out and look at all these things graphically so that you can figure out, okay, what impact, if I make that decision, does that have on something down the road? With the philosophy being you want to preserve your flexibility as far down the road as you possibly can. So instead of saying, oh, I'm going to go for my forever importer right away, oftentimes we recommend that people go through what we call a service importer, such as MHW, Park Street Imports, Siemens Beverage are all several that I work with, which allow you to function in markets like New Jersey and Connecticut, but not be held to those franchise standards. So gotcha. Even though New Jersey is a franchise state, there are ways to work around this.
Okay.
They're not all clean, and they're certainly not all easy, and they may not even be relevant to you, but that's part of this navigation of this complexity.
Okay, great. And FETs, just also?
Federal excise tax. Yeah. And the interesting thing there is the federal excise tax was X, right? And then in the Trump administration, they put in a temporary reduction of 90% reduction in FET, which ultimately was set in place. It's called the CBMA, Craft Beverage Modernization Act, with some limits. But what it means is the goal was to allow smaller producers to compete on a level playing field with the bigger producers.
Okay. Gotcha.
Hey, thank you. But it's still my ball.
Yeah. It's still, okay.
I want to go home, but I'm taking my ball and going home.
Right. Gotcha. Okay. There you go. Thank you for saying that, or talking about this. I think a lot of people, and I'm always surprised, Steve, occasionally when I'll here in Louisiana, because we are, you know, a three-tiered system, a pretty rigid three-tier system state. And so you are, you know, beholden to your distributor, the second tier. I've talked a lot about that on the show. And, you know, I personally, I'm on the record. I don't have any, you know, skin in this game. I'm not a big fan, because coming from California, I used to be able to, working at a winery, you know, restaurant calls and says, we're out of the cab. And okay, I'll drop a case in the back of my car and drop it off on my way home. And I'm a big fan of that. And I think that's really, especially for small producers, and especially when you're trying to, say, establish a local market, having to work through a distributor can be really, in my view, personally unfair. But why I want, thank you for talking about this, because what I want to have people understand is basically, as you just said, dealing with 52 different entities can be amazing. It's amazingly challenging for domestic producers. I can't imagine how challenging it could be for, outside of the country, you know, foreign producers, especially because they're probably, you know, they want to be in the U.S. market, but they're probably presumably in several other markets as well that are going to have their own rules for importation and distribution, correct?
Yeah, and more to the point, I've done that in California too, but if you did that in some states, like, in some states, you get arrested.
Yeah.
Yep. It's illegal.
Yep.
So you got to know the rules to play the game, and there's 52 different sets of rules.
Right.
So it comes back to my point about the U.S. isn't one country, and then when somebody does come to the U.S., they really need to think long and hard about where they want to be. And maybe the smart thing is not to go to New York and San Francisco and Miami because they're the biggest cities, but rather go to smaller markets like Minneapolis and Denver, where there's less competition, more receptivity to new ideas, and less restrictions than in those markets. And go to the bigger markets once you've figured out and demonstrated success and shown how your brand has actual traction, which we measure by repeat orders at retail. That's the only metric that matters.
Okay.
Is it pulling through?
Right.
It's easy to load in a product. It's not easy. I take it back. It's hard to load things in, but it's easier to load them in than it is to pull them through.
Right.
And if you do one and not the other, the truth will out.
Gotcha. Cool. Steve, we're going to take a break. You know, let's do this. Let's go ahead and take a break now, and then we're going to come back, and I want to ask you another question about sort of the landscape for the U.S. market and elsewhere, and then we're going to talk about your podcast. Stick around for a sec for me.
Roger. Great.
Friends, we're chatting with Steve Ray. Take a little break on the No Drink Show. Come on back.
find it dirt and wine. Yes, go down to the bar and buy me dirt and wine.
Hi, Brian Diaz, host of the NOLA Drink Show here. Check out Nitty Grits Podcasts, a growing network of food, drink, and culture shows. Visit southernfood.org for more.
Now, if you really want to roll, get you a big glass of whiskey, a double shot, and a drink of that old Rip Raw gin. Then drop a glass of wine into it. And put a half a glass of rum. And then stir it up with a little ice. And put a little milk in it. And when you drink that, boy, you're bound to roll on. Just go ahead and roll. Then you got you a roll on.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. We are chatting with Steve Ray, U.S. market expert for wines and spirits. And Steve, I wanted to ask you, we talked, various aspects of navigating the U.S. market for people that are looking to get their products into the country and around the country is probably a good way to put it. The one thing that we really haven't touched on specifically is how the online presence of both information and then actual retail, at least where that's available in certain places, that has radically altered the landscape, hasn't it?
Yeah, and think about it, that prohibition came about because of the temperance movement and preventing certain behaviors. And then we had the actual prohibition period where everybody violated it. And then we had the guys like Al Capone come in and vertically integrated it. So that when they created the laws, when prohibition got removed, it was to address the problems that existed in 1933. Well, we've come a long way since 1933. And, you know, the internet didn't exist back then. And so it has to fit under the aegis of either existing laws or new laws that pass. So, or laws that are in place. So basically the three, we're just talking about wine now because spirits are much more narrowly focused.
Right.
But in wines, there's only one way that anybody in the beverage alcohol business can bypass the three-tier system. And that's a domestic winery that can sell directly to a consumer. We tend to call that DTC, direct to consumer. It sometimes can be a misnomer. It's under the umbrella heading of e-commerce, mm-hmm. because most of it takes place, all of it takes place online, but they're very different things. And so a domestic winery can sell directly to a consumer, an imported wine cannot, mm-hmm. nor can an importer. It has to go through the three-tier system. That's just kind of a microcosm of the complexities that are out there and the opportunities that are out there. You mix all that together in a blender, throw in a bunch of onions, carrots, and some spices from different parts of the world, and you have this confusing thing called e-commerce in wines and spirits.
Right.
So retailers can sell to consumers in some other states, but it varies between what state you're in and what state you're shipping to, right. and how assiduously you follow the laws there or how those laws are enforced. And that varies in terms of time, whether or not the state beverage alcohol commission is going to be actively enforcing those things. And if so, why? So there is no answer to how many states can one retailer ship to for wines and how many can you ship to for spirits. The fact is that that's possible. It is easier to ship intrastate within the state. So a New York State retailer who can only have one license in New York State can ship to a person in New York State, but they can't ship to someone like me in Connecticut. Intra versus interstate. Yet right. there are a lot of people who are doing interstate e-commerce very well, all the way up to and including the pure play of that, which is wine.com, which has figured out a way to create a network that enables them to effectively sell directly to consumers with all of the complexities hidden. As far as the consumer is concerned, I go online, I order something, and I can buy it.
Because they partnered up with a local retailer that can do what they need them to do, right?
A local retail solution. And that's what I want to talk about, because the reality is the bedrock of our industry is the local retailers and the knowledge and position they have in a local community as being the place where people can find what they want. They're limited by the number of SKUs that can be in a particular store. But at the end of the day, it's the retailer who is kind of the point of contact. I believe strongly in that. There's a lot of tools out there that we call third-party facilitators, TPF, which means they just broker the deal. They don't take ownership of the product. They don't buy it and then resell it to somebody else, but they clip the ticket on somehow in a legal way for it to go. The fundamental difference being that it's that retailer, that third party, the third party facilitator that owns the relationship with the consumer. Whereas if a in-state retailer is selling direct to an in-state consumer, the retailer has the relationship with the customer and can remarket to them.
Right.
So while at first blush, you'd say, okay, e-commerce is great for everybody. It's giving you customers outside of your traditional geographic area. Yeah, but it's also taking control away. And I think that's a fundamental thing that many, many people in the industry either overlook, aren't aware of, or don't recognize the significance of.
Okay, great. Steve, you're going to be sticking around for our podcast-only segment, Another Shot with NOLA Drinks, and we'll get further into this. We have about 4 minutes left before we have to close out the portion of the radio show. Can you tell us briefly about the podcast that you do? Because it's a really terrific resource.
Yeah. My publisher happens to have a big operation in Verona, Italy. And I wrote a book. She convinced me to write a book. Actually, she said, we're going to write a book. And she said, actually, you're going to write it. I'm going to publish it. Great. And then when that was done, she said, okay, now we're going to do a podcast. And once again, you're going to do the podcast and I'll back it up. And so they have a staff for editing and all the rest of that. And that's turned into the Italian Wine Podcast, which now has about 300,000 monthly listens. It's 7 days a week. I do one of the daily shows, the Monday show. Mine alone has 20,000 listeners, which is astonishing to me because it's a very trade-oriented site. Even my children, family, you know, don't listen to it because it's subject matter, right?
I know that.
But it's been really wonderful. And so the cool thing is when I'm walking around in Italy and I have a sticker of the Italian Wine Podcast, people are coming up to me and they're saying, oh, Professore Ray. And I do teach at the University of Bologna, or I give lectures there once a semester. But they come up to me and I'm kind of like a minor celebrity. And it's like, wow, this is really cool, which is why I do it. At the end of the day, it's a real ego gratifier that people think I really know what I'm talking about. So don't fool anybody and let them know that I really don't. Okay.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Steve, how do people get, so there's it's a wide array of topics on Italian wine, right? So you
I go far beyond Italian wine. That's just in the title.
But what you do, yes. but then also what's your other hosts on, it's kind of more of like a network than really the Italian wine podcast. Yeah.
Yeah. My email is steve@bevologyinc.com. The name of the book I wrote is How to Get U.S. Market Ready. It's available on Amazon.com, also Amazon.it, and also at getusmarketready.com. And the website is bevologyinc.com.
Okay, great. And we got there a little quicker than I thought. So I wanted to clarify, too, with the podcast network. So you do the Monday show. What are the other four? Is it different avenues of Italian wine, different sort of types of topics?
Yeah. So one of them is voices, and it's deep into DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Another one is a very scientific based show in Italian with Attilio Scienza, who is a ampelographer, studies morphology of grapevines, and it gets like really into heavy, deep stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there's another kind of deep interview that Polly Hammond does on Sundays, which is an hour long. Mine are usually about 30 minutes. And mine focus more on like what we've been talking about, things people don't really know about, but can benefit from. So it's a real diverse range. One of them's about wine and food, Mark Millen.
Okay. So kind of it'll whet your appetite for all things Italian wine from a very broad-based
and that's
spectrum.
Just the Italian Wine Podcast itself. There are some other channels associated with it. Okay. Like Stevie Kim does On the Road Edition, where she goes to all these wineries and does personal interviews with the winemaker. We're in competition for sources.
Gotcha. Right.
All the time.
Gotcha. Very cool. All right, Steve. So what we're going to do, we're going to close out the portion of the radio show here in just a moment. Friends, I will tell you that Steve is going to be sticking around for our podcast only segment, Another Shot with Nola Drinks. That is waiting for you now, the entire show. If you go to noladrinks.com, you can find out more about this show and you can get the podcast from our website or from wherever you get your podcasts. All the links are right there. You can also see more. We'll have links to Steve's stuff in our show notes as well. If you are listening on the radio, friends, I do appreciate it. Remember to be kind to one another. Use your turn signal. And until next time, cheers all. Everybody, hey, thanks for sticking around for another Shot with Nola Drinks. Hope you are enjoying this conversation with U.S. market expert for wine and spirits, Steve Ray. I know I'm digging the conversation, learning a lot here, friends. We're going to bounce right back over to our chat with Steve Ray. Here we go. All right, everybody, yep, another Shot with Nola Drinks. Thanks for sticking around, friends. We are chatting with Steve Ray, who operates the BevologyInc.com website, author of How to Get U.S. Market Ready, and expert in wine and spirits in the U.S. market. And Steve, pleasure to talk to you. And I'll mention this too, because I did say this very briefly during the interview. You were kind enough to have me on your show that we taped last week, and I know that's going to be coming out in a few weeks, but I just wanted to thank you for that opportunity. It's rare that I get the guest turn.
Oh, yeah. No, the same thing for me, too. It was really fortuitous. We met, we had mentioned this earlier in the radio show, at Tales of the Cocktail. And I was working a booth for one of my clients. And as we were talking, it came out that I did a podcast and you did a podcast. And all of a sudden, we kind of moved away from the booth and started sharing stories and right. All that. It was like, okay, this is an unusual thing. I guess I hadn't met any other podcasters up until then. And it was absolutely delightful to meet you. And how this whole thing came to be was like, oh, we're having a lot of fun. That's what it's
absolutely
all about.
And you know how we click, Steve, I think, as I recall, we started talking about distributors in the distribution network in Louisiana. So I knew we were kindred spirits on that part because I was ripping on them. And yeah, you were a little more deft and diplomatic than I was, but I was complaining about the distribution.
Well, we had challenges getting our samples into Louisiana for a variety of reasons. Number one, we're not commercially for sale in the U.S. now. And so that was a fundamental problem. We were also in the wrong size. So the people that we worked with as our local clearing wholesaler, we went through all of the proper channels and did everything right. But even when you think you know what you're doing, you don't have a clue because each state is so different. And I found out a lot about Louisiana that I didn't know. And
it's maybe
didn't want to know, but now I do.
Yeah. So. It's a funny state. And I share this anecdote from time to time, but I haven't shared it on the show in a good while, given what you and I were talking about. I'll never forget standing out in front of a local brewery
My friend, good friend, was the beer maker there. They're no longer in business, and he's moved on to different pastures in the beer world. But we were standing out in the doorway in front of the brewery, and we're looking about a block and a half towards downtown Covington, which is a city just north of New Orleans, which you probably know. And we're looking at a bar called the Tap Room, and I'll name them. And they moved a ton of their product. And he said, you know, I just got a call from the tap room that they were out of whatever, you know, out of the keg of whatever beer we were talking about. And he said, isn't that weird that I'm looking at their front door? I have a hand truck right here. I have the keg that's going to ultimately be on their tap system right here. Yet somebody has to come in a van from the distributorship, pick it up, bring it back to their HQ, which is 15 miles away, and then put it on a delivery truck and bring it back to the tap room. He's like, I could just walk that SOB over there right now and we could be done with this. And it was just
You can't.
And I mean, it was so poignant to me. I mean, and I was well aware of this, that this is how the system worked. But when you think about how ridiculous that is on a practical level, I mean, it's like, you could still make the money as a distributor and just do the paperwork, man. I'll just hand truck it over. So, you know, right now we're losing pours. So it's just a whole thing. Anyway, and we've been talking about that quite a bit on the show, and I appreciate that. Let me ask you this question, Steve, because I know when, like, we're talking about, I'm going to ask you a couple different questions here, but let's start with this one. Working, you're talking about the knowledge that producers outside the country need to have to be effective, and I'm kind of paraphrasing, obviously, but to effectively navigate the U.S. market and know what they're talking about and say the right things and work with the right people and just make the right decisions. That's got to be even extra challenging for small producers, right? Because they don't have the budget to hire reps, or, you know, have the budget necessarily to have people working for them, or even hiring consultants and things like that. That I'm imagining that can be very, very daunting for a small producer. And why I'm even mentioning this too is because now, with what I think people are liking to drink in many instances and wanting to get their hands on, are those small little guys that are making interesting things. So we have a little bit of a split here, is that there is a lot of barriers for small guys to get into the market. And for those of us who are consumers, we're missing out, I think, probably on a lot of stuff that we'd like to have in our bottles and in our glasses.
Yeah, that's true. But along with those, think of those, each of those barriers as an opportunity, and other people, a lot of technology money, we were talking about e-commerce before, are chasing that. You know, the idea of buying online is the endless aisle. There's no limit to inventory that's available online. That's not exactly true in the liquor industry, because it's got to be cut up by the 52 different regulatory entities. But conceptually, it is, so that you're not limited to the number of SKUs that fit on a particular shelf or a back bar. That said, it's pretty easy to learn this stuff. I tell people, I've got a bunch of webinars on my site. You can watch the webinars. You can read the book. If anybody wants to, I have a glossary of industry terms.
Oh, cool.
It's a four page document I give people for free. You want to get real smart on the industry real quick so that you can know what the buzzwords and acronyms are. That part, most people worry about the wrong things, right? That's the easy stuff. The stuff that you really need to worry about is, what is the right thing for my brand, for my resources, my time frame, my production capabilities? And generally speaking, that's not anything that anybody can figure out on their own. Because you need to adapt what you're going to do to the U.S. market. Let's say, for example, you're an Italian winery that's only producing 10,000 9-liter equivalent cases, and you're only going to export 2,000 to the U.S. You don't need to be available nationally. You can probably do all that with one chain. And I just used, it could be Rouse's in Louisiana.
They
have like 9 stores or something like that. You can move 2,000 cases through. Maybe it's a lot for that one store, but still in all. ABC in Florida has 26 stores. BevMo has, I think, like 80 or 90 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there are different solutions for different situations. And I think you can't just lump everybody into one size does not fit all. And so the strategies have to be very, very different too.
Okay.
And you can't do that on your own. You do need a guide. A lot of people say you need a Sherpa. I can do that. But there's a lot of people just like me. And basically anybody who's been in the business for more than a couple of years knows this, because that's how you learn. And we've all been burnt by the same thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've all got scars.
Absolutely. Now, and since you just mentioned like BevMo, for example, we've also here in Louisiana just had Total Wine move into the state within the past, you know, 3 or so, 4 years maybe. And so now that we see, you know, Costco being another example of some of these sort of big box warehousey type stores, one of the things that I notice at Freak, and it's, you know, the reality of it, is very rarely do I go into one of those stores. I'm not intimidated to go into those stores because I generally know what I'm looking for, but the lack of knowledge that you get in those stores can be very troubling to me at times. And like there are people that have good staff and people that are knowledgeable, but it can also be just very, very hit or miss. So when you're advising somebody who's a producer trying to navigate that landscape, what do you tell them? Because I mean, like if you're in a small bottle shop that's, you know, locally run and they know their stuff and they're going to hand sell you, because what we are, that's really where I'm going with this. Things need to be hand sold in a lot of these instances. And when we start talking about both online purchasing and big box store or big, you know, warehouse type store purchasing, hand selling becomes very, very difficult. That's got to limit exposure for some brands and producers, correct?
Yeah. And I think the problem is that a lot of producers from outside the country who are used to selling through supermarkets in these other countries where they do distribute, Germany, Spain, Italy, France. But since you can't buy wine and spirits in supermarkets in all the states, and in fact, not really many states, well, a fair amount, maybe half, something like that. But they only carry a limited selection. And so the smaller ones are not going to be there. The higher priced ones are not going to be there. You really need to focus on, you call them mom and pops. I call them independent retailers. And I think that's the lifeblood of the industry and really the skeleton on which everything is based. Big box stores and Total Wines exist because they can move lots of volume, lots of people through it. And they, Total Wines can, has tremendous shelf space, certainly like 5-10 times what a typical small retailer will be. But you can pretty much be sure that somebody in a small retail store would have already tasted the wine, talked to whoever was behind it, and can tell you some anecdotes about it. The people at Total Wine do a great job of that too. But Total's strategy, if you look at it, they do a lot of private label business, and their program is called Winery Direct. And when you go into one of their stores, you can see that. And they seem to be promoting Winery Direct. Now, and I understand why. It's a great business strategy, and it works for them. So for smaller brands, and this goes for spirits as well as wines, I think you're better off looking at either on-premise and or a combination of on-premise plus off-premise stores where you show them commitment by being in there and doing in-store tastings on a regular basis every 6 weeks for a period of 6 months or something to help build the brand in that particular store. Now it's not so much an issue of selling your wine in, it's helping that retailer make money from carrying your wine. And that's what their interest is. It's not in your brand per se. But if you show interest in what keeps them alive, helping them make money, then they're going to be good business partners for you for the long run. And that's what I try and focus on. There's a time and a place and a brand that is right for Total Wines and for supermarkets. And I believe like supermarkets in Louisiana is a very different animal than, say, Safeway in California.
Right, very much.
I think you have to adapt your expectations to the market and be careful about where you're going and focus. If you don't stand for something, you'll stand for anything.
Okay, great. Well said. Two more questions for you, Steve. On price, and I'm sure you probably have these conversations with producers quite often, there's sort of a constant drive. I know, like, for example, I mean, I'll cut this a couple of different ways, but we had this big trend in New Orleans going back probably 10, 15 years where everybody and their mother was opening up an independent retail, small, you know, mom and pop, using that term again, bottle shop in different neighborhoods. And several of them, their emphasis was, you know, good stuff under $20. Good stuff under $20. And that trend seems to kind of ebbed a little bit, I think. But, you know, I think that was driving, especially, you know, people like these smart finds for under $20 was driving a lot of the retail market in a certain situation. And then when we sort of layer on top of that by the glass considerations of what a bottle needs to wholesale for, when you're talking about price with people, for a small producer in particular, meeting those price numbers, meaning having them be low enough to actually get under that bar, can be very difficult. Do you find that people from outside the country, producers are kind of maybe even overly worried about that? Like, I've got to get this by my, you know, my pricing has to be by the glass friendly, or my pricing has to be, I can get it in a small retailer for under $20. Or do you think, is it just all over the map?
That's not the way they look at it. Well, that is one way of stating the same thing. I think the way they look at it is the shock when you explain to them, take your XLR, talking about wine now,
yep.
Take your XLR price. And now that there's parity between the euro and the dollar, let's say your XLR price is $4. That wine is probably going to retail at a store at about 16. So 3.5 to 4X what the XLR price is. Now, this is a producer, right? So he's selling it for €4, right? He's got a either buy the grapes or own the land and grow the grapes. He's got to farm the grapes. He's got to deal with floods and, you know, ice storms and all kinds of other things. He's got to hire the people. He's got to hold the wine in inventory before bottling so that it ages. He's got all of these costs, which are not variable costs. They're fixed costs.
Glass, and they're all enclosures, shipping, yeah,
and
the whole thing. Yeah.
And saying everybody else, if you look at where the value is along the price structure chain in the US, everybody else along the way is making more money than they are. And that's when they finally tumbled to that. Said, wait, and I show them a price structure. Said, wait a second, everybody else is making more money on my brand than I am, and I have to own, do all this stuff. And my response is, that's true. And if you have a problem with that, you shouldn't be here. Right. It's the reality. We're not going to change that. That's the way the US is structured. There's a lot of margin in a price structure that we all kind of are stuck with. And it all begins with what is the acquisition price or the XLR price. This is true to some degree or a similar degree in spirits as well. So I think if you're talking about under $20 wines, yes, that's becoming a lot more of a challenge now, because that's basically $5 or €5 XLR.
I think people, and thank you for sharing that, because I think a lot of people, you'll hear on the news that there's, you know, the cost of glass bottles has gone up, or there's a shortage of glass bottles, or the cost of corks have gone up, or enclosures in general have gone up, and they'll say, you know, gone up 5 cents or 3 cents or something. And people will go, well, that's not very much. But when you're talking about the way, in very much as you just said, the costs and the margin that the producer has to endure or bear, those small changes can be a really big deal on whether your bottle is going to end up in a $20 or under bottle shop, or whether your wine is actually viable to be on a buy the glass list in a US restaurant.
Yeah. And so a lot of people come to me and say, well, I don't want to go through the three-tier system. I want to bypass the three-tier system because everybody is making margin and they're not really adding to value. Well, that's not an option for you. And it's not a problem you're going to solve. And if that's the thing that's going to bother you and keep you up at night, don't come.
Yeah. Great point. Let me ask you one last question, Steve. And I'm going to kind of put you on the hook here with your expert opinion. We were talking about some of the big box stores, you know, the Total Wines and BevMo's of the world. And I'm going to use Louisiana just as an example, because that's where I'm sitting at the moment. But we mentioned this, a lot of people listening that are locally listening know this, that we have a rigid three-tiered system. You have to sell through a distributor, who's the second tier here. Now, and it's still very rigid in Louisiana. And I talk to a lot of people who think that will never change in Louisiana. And we've talked about this a lot on the show. I don't need to go through a lot of those reasons. And sometimes what I point out is like the state of Washington, right? Where things in the state of Washington a few years ago changed, really due in large part to Costco coming in, and, you know, they're a behemoth. So they were able to sort of force the hand of things and make changes. Now that we have Costco here in Louisiana, now that we have Total Wine here in Louisiana and other similar states, do you think the writing is on the wall that we might see broader changes continuing to happen? I mean, Florida is a state that rolled over a few years ago on a lot of this. Do we think a lot of people are just basically doomsayers here or naysayers here, and they think it's never going to change. What do you think about that? Do you think that it's inevitable that it'll change everywhere, or
Yeah, I guarantee it will change. How it will change and whether that change would or would not be favorable to independent stores and how that would impact individual brands is a separate question. Right. But yeah, because regulations are always evolving. As I said, they were set up in 1933 to deal with problems that existed back then. The internet wasn't invented, and there's 1,000 other ramifications like that that impact what's going on now. You know, used to be in Texas, you're next door to Texas. I know Dallas County itself was a dry county, and the only way you could buy liquor and all the restaurants were on the road that was on the border of the county, right?
Right, exactly.
So there are ways of dealing with things, and when those things change, other things change as well. I don't see the three-tier system going away, but I do see it evolving, but also much more slowly than you would see regulations evolving in like technology or even insurance for that more. And insurance is very much like the beverage alcohol industry in that it's primarily state regulated.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Because and the reason why I even asked that question, and I had this conversation, as you can tell, a lot with people here. And again, coming from California, having worked directly with distributors, you know, you can choose in beer and wine, of course, you can choose to work with a distributor. And I always kind of joke, half serious, that in California, distributors work for their money because you're not stuck with them and you don't have to use them if they're not doing their job. And so, and I mean, I know that's kind of great, grossly overstating certain things, but like, for example, working with a small winery in the Bay Area, one of them that I did, you know, they wanted to get into Southern California. Winery is too small to hire sales reps to cover Southern California. So we hired a distributor for the LA area and the LA market because mm-hmm. we had to, and it was a smart business decision to do that. But we self-distributed in Northern California because we were sizable enough to do that. So kind of where I'm going with this, even talking about the beer thing, being able to bring beer over to the local bar, you know, I'm a firm believer that there should be a choice. And especially for small producers, if you're trying to build a market, it's not a one size fits all thing. But I find like a lot of my friends in the craft beer industry here, they want self-distribution up until a certain point, and then they need distribution because they get big enough that it's actually beneficial to them. And so that's really why I asked you that question is, you know, I believe that there should be a choice because that business model needs to be flexible to facilitate local production or facilitate small producers to get into the game.
Well, in fact, that's exactly what happened with the CBMA, the reduction of federal excise tax. The idea was to empower smaller producers to pay less in taxes so that they would have more money to put into marketing and all that kind of stuff. But the way the law was written, it's for the first 100,000 proof gallons in the case of spirits, which means everybody from Jim Beam and Diageo on down, including small distilleries, get the benefit of that first 100,000 proof gallons. You don't get it beyond that, but still in all. So it's a good thing for the smaller producers. It helps to level the playing field a little bit, but it doesn't level the whole playing field. You still got to move the ball down the field. And that's a lot of blocking and tackling and passing and understanding what the reality is of how that's going to be. And that's how, you know, the Mets won in 1969.
Right. Hey, there you go. Especially since you guys
mixing metaphors there between football and baseball, but you get the point.
Hey, I like it. I know we're recording this on the Monday, so I know the Subway Series between the Yankees and the Mets starts tonight because I'm a baseball guy. So
okay,
I was paying attention to that. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your time and your insight and the conversation. Can you tell people one more time where we can connect with you, find the book, and find the podcast, please?
Sure. You can call me directly. Actually, reach out to me directly on email, steve@bevologyinc.com. The book is available on amazon.com or also at getusmarketready.com. And my company website is bevologyinc.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Steve. We'll have friends.
Thank you. This was great. Absolutely. Really glad we met. And next time I'm in NOLA, we're having dinner again.
Ed, that's going to be, I'm looking forward to it, man. I know you're down here on a fairly regular basis, so I absolutely look forward to it. And thank you very much, Steve. It's been a real pleasure. And I'll see you next year at Tales too, I'm sure, all that good stuff.
Yep. So we'll great. Be there.
And friends, if you're listening out there, I'll have links to all this stuff in our show notes. So just go to noladrinks.com and check that out. You can connect with Steve that way. And at this point, after a brief musical interlude, I will be back to close things out. All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for listening to the show this week, friends. Happy to have had you here. As always, as I mentioned, we're going to be off next week for a planned break, and then we're going to be back the following week with a new show for you, chatting with the guys from St. George Distilling out there in Alameda, California, which is right by Oakland in the San Francisco Bay Area. Really, really fine distillery, and I can't wait to bring you that conversation. They just make some fantastic stuff. I think I talked about this recently on the show. Right before Tales the Cocktail, I had a chance to sit down with Dave Smith, who is their president of vices is the title that he has, but he's the president of the company and basically had a private tasting, and he's a great dude. And we sat there and chatted for a couple hours, actually tasted through a whole bunch of their portfolio. I had had the good fortune of tasting quite a bit of their stuff at different bars and different places in recent years, but there was a whole bunch of other stuff that I had yet to taste until that point. Really, really delicious stuff. There's a wide range of things that they do, but it's all done really well. So we're going to be chatting with them about what it is that they do, what it is that they make, their philosophy, what they're trying to accomplish. Really, it'll be a really fascinating conversation. If you're into quality spirits, these guys are it. So looking forward to bringing you that one after our brief break. And yeah, we mentioned this at the top of the show. We're going to be in the near future, a couple things to be on the lookout for. We're going to be chatting with our friends from Turning Tables about their recent trip to Mexico. That's going to be really cool. Speaking of Mexico and that area of Mexico, as a matter of fact, we're going to be chatting with the guys from Denada Tequila, which is a new tequila brand. Couple young guys that went to Tulane University and then got into the tequila business. But importantly, they are working with a generational family that's been making tequila, I think for, if I remember right, five generations, something along those lines, in Mexico. And that's who does the work for them. So their master distiller, who is a Mexican gentleman, will be joining us as well. So it's gonna be a really interesting conversation, I think, just talking about their brand. They're very dedicated to environmental sustainability and cultural sustainability and what they do. So looking forward to bringing you that one. There you go. I want to flag a couple things to your attention. You probably know this already because I talk about it. This program, the podcast version, which is what you're hearing, right? Because this is the podcast only segment, go figure. The podcast airs on the Nitty Grits Podcast Network, or I should say is part of the Nitty Grits Podcast Network. And that network is the podcast network of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum located here in New Orleans in Central City, a very, very fine institution. You can go to southernfood.org to learn more. Support them. If you live in the area, please go visit them. It's a great museum, but they're also always looking for memberships from people in the public and others, and always looking for donations to support their terrific wide-ranging program and programming. Now, what I would also like to bring to your attention is you can connect with the Nitty Grits Podcast Network on social media. On Instagram, it's Nitty Grits Podcasts. So NITTY Grits, GRITS Podcasts, and it is the same on Facebook. So just Instagram at Nitty Grits Podcasts, Facebook at Nitty Grits Podcasts, and you'll start to see stuff. We're kind of ramping all that up, but it's a growing network of really, really cool shows. As a matter of fact, we are in the process of adding another really exciting show. We're going to have news on that very, very soon. So you can check that out as well. I'll be talking about that. Probably have the new show host on in short order as well. But go check it out. It's a great way to connect with the network. Obviously, you're listening to this show, but there's some other fine shows that are part of it that you'll want to discover, kind of wide ranging, as long as it touches the world of food and drink and the broader cultures and culture connected to those things, you will find it there. And so, yeah, go check it out. Nitty Grits Podcast. So southernfood.org, that's a place to check. And then at Nitty Grits Podcasts on Instagram and Facebook. Find us there. So that's all I got for you, friends. We'll see you, be talking to you in about a couple weeks or thereabouts. Here's to you.